Part 3, Chapter 10, in which the early worm gives Harvey the bird, and the tetrad meet the lotophagi. The rising sun, marking its path with unfailing regularity, had carried the captain 8 hours closer to death when it called him to breakfast with the squirrels. The berries were fresh and plump, but before they could finish eating, their meal was interrupted by a small robin that fluttered down from the upper branches. The bird was in search of a breakfast of its own, and when the squirrels refused to share, it descended to the earth. Harvey rose to follow. The captain was untrained in the ways of hunting worms, but his experience at the university had taught him how to bury his nose in dark places, and as the hunter turned to his business, Harvey stood by and took notes. First the bird remained perfectly still, looking out of both sides of its face. Then it took 3 quick steps, lowered its head, raised it, then stood motionless. Then it pecked the earth. Then it stood still. Then it pecked again. It seemed to be sending some sort of Morse code, and Harvey interpreted it as a call that he should join the hunt. Repeating the process, as he had observed, the captain began to peck, then stopped, then pecked, then stopped. Finally, a worm emerged from the soil. It was fat and shiny, and Harvey was all aflutter with excitement, but as soon as he went to seize it, the animal threw itself around his ankles and pulled him to the ground. The battle that ensued might well have been the most ferocious in history. Harvey struggled to get away, but the Gusanus tyrannus, still holding his ankle, wrapped the other end of itself around a root and began to thrash the captain against the ground. Harvey screeched and squawked, and it looked as though the ruthless invertebrate might finish him once and for all. But Hesiod came by on his way to class and smashed the offender on the toe of his shoe. He was still cleaning his sneaker when Harvey rose to his feet. "Thanks," chirped the captain. That day in class, Harvey was again paired with Alessandra, and while they were working, Aphrodite sent down her son. Taking care not to miss this time, he shot an arrow through Alessandra's heart that sliced her aorta and came out her side, continuing its flight until it grazed the arm of the captain. They confessed their love with the only words they knew. "Isi anthos," she said. "Ise vrohi," she replied. "Ise selini," he said. "Ise leakava," she replied. Translation: "You are flower," he said. "You are rain," she replied. "You are moon," he said. "You are sun," she replied. Alessandra longed to know the captain better, but a natural reserve prevented her from asking him out, and he was likewise prevented from asking her. Eventually, she decided to have a friend ask for her, and on Thursday after class, her friend did as she was told, and Harvey agreed to meet Alessandra at the opera on Saturday. He was to confirm the arrangement the next day with Alessandra herself. That afternoon, it seemed as if spring had burst upon the city in a single day. The trees were suddenly thick and filled with sound. The breeze was warm in the folds of Harvey's clothes, and the gardens were teeming with a myriad of colors. The light was different, too, sifting through the tiers of leaves, and the changing shadows gave a different feel to the hills and valleys. On the way to his tree, the captain ran into his friends the squirrels. They led him to a series of beautiful green knolls surrounding a lone pine tree. Footnote: some historians believe the spot to be the space between 330 North and Center Street, while others point to the opening at 500 North and Grant. Growing evidence supports the former claim. Back to the text. They led him to a series of beautiful green knolls surrounding a lone pine tree. Harvey was in squirrel heaven, scampering and leaping with the rhythm of the land, bounding about, rolling to the bottom of hills, tearing through the flowers, and darting among the silent stones. Occasionally, the chase would lead him across the streets, and he quickly learned to keep his tail high over the asphalt, then let it flop again on the grass. He also learned, when a human screamed by in an automobile, to duck into the drains that ran beneath the intersections of the roads. When the shadows began to extend on the grasses, Harvey invited his friends to his home, but on the way they found a discarded box of saltwater taffy, and in no time they were all shaking with sugar. The scene was like a Hitchcock movie. The frenzied rodents storming the tree, swinging from branch to branch, tearing up and down the trunk. One of the squirrels leapt from the pine to the top of the row of maples that bordered the path, and a friend followed, and then another, and another, until the entire canopy was shaking and bursting with high-pitched squeals. Harvey jumped in, squealing and leaping and like, until the sugar wore off and he collapsed in bed. When Harvey woke the next day, the tree was empty, except for the torn leaves and branches the squirrels had left behind. Suddenly he looked at the sun and remembered his Greek class. He was late. He rushed to the university, hoping Alessandra would still be there, but the hour was over when he arrived, and there was no one in the room. Crestfallen, he wandered the halls until Thales found him and took him to their next class. The professor was showing slides of the work of Bruegel the Elder when they settled into their seats. One of them, a picture of The Fall of Icarus, portrayed a group of peasants that were uninterested in the boy's great fall, and the captain became nostalgic. Mahogany would have noticed, he thought, if he had been there. Then Dr. Campbell picked up his lecture of the day before. In the Hindu tradition, he began, it is the loss of self that enables us to see the oneness of all things. Hey, whispered Thales, are you coming to the home of the Lotophagy?
The home of the Lotophagy? Echoed Harvey.
Some religions, Campbell continued, tell us we won't experience bliss until we die and go to heaven. But I believe in having as much as you can while you are still alive.
Yeah, whispered Thales. Pan's new apartment. We're going to meet there before the concert.
The concert? Echoed Harvey. The biblical tradition, said Campbell, is a socially oriented mythology. In it, nature is condemned. It had to be, for to accept the ancient idea of nature as divinity would have kept us from achieving dominance over it. How can you cut down trees and uproot the land and turn rivers into real estate without killing God? God must be separate from nature for such abuses to take place. It's right there in Genesis. We are to be the masters of the world.
Tim Weisberg, said Thales, in front of the Union Plaza.
In front of the Union Plaza? Echoed Harvey.
Exactly, said Thales.
But if you think of yourselves as coming from the earth, Dr. Campbell continued, if you realize we are the earth, the destruction of the earth becomes the destruction of ourselves. The Native American Indians understood this. Chief Seattle, in his letter to the president in 1852, wrote, "The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected, like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself." When they arrived at the home of the Lotophagy, Harvey and Thales climbed the indoor stairway from the porch to the second floor.
They were met on the stairs by the aroma of incense and burnt offerings, and as they entered the apartment, they felt they were walking into the warm center of a cloud. Pan's roommate, Epimetheus, almost forgot to greet them, darning his jeans and sitting naked on the floor, while Pan was in the tub, talking through the open door to the visitors who were milling about, playing instruments, singing, and dancing. The afternoon sun was streaming in through the windows, awakening the scents of wheatgrass, sandalwood, and tiger balm, and the entire apartment seemed to be floating on air, blown from place to place. Harvey and Thales partook of the offerings, and when Hesiod and Prometheus and Arete arrived, they were all rendered indolent by the pull of the apartment. The lethargy was so strong, in fact, that they might have remained there forever, except that a passing cloudburst sent a cool breeze through the windows that drew them outside. The rain had knocked the yellow buds from the trees, covering the sidewalks and grasses, and they gazed upon the whitening clouds, inhaling the dripping freshness. It was not yet time for the concert, so Thales led them to his fraternity near the university campus. The fraternity house was a startling contrast to the rain-washed afternoon. Its dark halls were more like an alley in Istanbul, and the river of people that wound through its rooms were pushy and bold. They were informed that the river led to the pit in the basement, and when Harvey first stepped in, his foot was almost torn from his leg, and he was glad he didn't have to step into the same river twice. The first hook to catch them as they floated along was the upside-down margarita bar, where they all tried their mouths as blenders, washing away their brains. Then they were hooked in a stairwell painted with a collage of numbers, and they were forced to wait as number 1165 toasted number 1414, and they finished a pint of vodka. When they finally reached the pit, they were netted by a woman dressed in veils, sporting two pendulous breasts.
"Arrgh!" growled the captain, recognizing the woman as Salome. "Beware the pit and the pendulous."
But the crowd paid no heed, and before Harvey could warn them again, the scantily clad woman climbed upon a table and began to dance and undress. The next 30 minutes were an essay in hormonal delirium. There were tricks with suckers, brushes, and tweezers, and the tit-for-tat of humiliation, until every John in the room was willing to give her their head upon a platter. Even Harvey was affected, for before he could begin to imitate the dancer, she reached beyond his emptiness and seized him by his primal desires. The show ended just in time for the concert, and they could hear the first song reverberating off the buildings as they crossed the street to the campus. When they reached the Union Plaza, the show was in full swing. There were burnt offerings everywhere, and everywhere Harvey looked, he saw a reflection of himself. One person swayed like a tree, another drifted like a cloud, another darted like a fish, another roared like a lion. At one point, he noticed a couple doing the lizard dance, and he remembered Nyssa, and became sad at the thought of Mahogany, so many years away. Lost in his thoughts, he accidentally separated the couple and was suddenly transformed into a woman. A woman. Among the plethora of personalities in Harvey's past, he had often been a woman in spirit, but never a woman in the flesh. It was quite different than he had supposed. He had not anticipated the impact of this first impression. Suddenly she felt she was viewed as a woman first and a person second, and her appearance was more closely scrutinized before her opinions were considered. Fortunately, she was a handsome woman, and her first impression was not a negative one, though even her beauty brought challenges of its own. And then there was her position on the other side of the chase. No sooner had the captain lost his manhood than she felt herself being undressed by the eyes of 100 men. They followed her wherever she went, some moving close enough to venture an ice-breaking cliché, some snickering a passing obscenity, and some simply staring from a distance. She quickly learned the dangers of being too congenial, for a friendly salutation was often construed as a brazen advance. It took more courage to be unguarded and carefree, and it took a great deal of patience to care for men at all. She thought of all the women he had ever met, and how he had never really understood them. She thought of Alessandra, and how she must have felt when he didn't appear in class, and she thought of the scene he had just witnessed in the pit. A certain part of the episode had appealed to him, as it had to Thales and Prometheus, not because they were mean or abusive or evil-spirited, but because they were male animals, instinctively excited by the sight of an undressed female. The question of humiliation was another matter, and better left to an expert more learned than she. Regarding the question of sexual excitement, the biggest difference, as far as she could tell, was the extent of stimulation by sight. Though as a woman Harvey could certainly be excited by the sight of a handsome male, the lust was nothing compared with what women had inspired in him when he was a man. In the end, because of lack of practice, or because of the world itself, Harvey found it much more difficult to be a woman, and she was anxious to change back. So determined, she found the lizard couple that had resumed their dance and moved in between them. As soon as she did, she returned to himself, but not without a feeling that she had lost something miraculous he would never have again.